This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
How do imperial legacies shape present-day academia and knowledge production? How are the colonial past and obligations arising from it debated today? What role do they play in political relations within Europe and in Europe's relations with the rest of the world? These are some of the questions we seek to address in our 8-lecture series in cooperation with the Fritz Thyssen Foundation on science, knowledge, and the legacy of empire. This podcast episode is a recording of the 3rd lecture in the series, given by Frederick Cooper, Professor Emeritus of History at New York University, under the title Understanding Power Relations in a Colonial Context, Top Down, Bottom Up, In Between. Frederick Cooper's lecture explores power relations in the colonial and post-colonial world through Leopold Sédar Senghor's ideas of horizontal and vertical solidarity. Horizontal solidarity represents the commonality of cause among people who share a common culture or social status, while vertical solidarity refers to the relationship between the top and the bottom of a political or social order. Senghor used these concepts to challenge French colonial rule in West Africa, arguing that analyzing colonialism through these two forms of solidarity could reshape our understanding of its exploitative dynamics. In this lecture, Frederick Cooper rethinks how power relations work in post-colonial contexts and challenges some of the recent historical views of colonialism and its post-colonial afterlife, primarily in terms of top-down power relations.
I would like to begin by thanking the German Historical Institute of London and the Thyssen Foundation for sponsoring and organizing this event, and especially Dr. Surman for coming here for it. And of course, Christina von Hodenberg for a generous introduction, and Indra Sangupta for her correspondence with me over the last months and for taking the lead in putting this event together. So let me begin. Around the time when I became a student of history in the late 1960s, scholars were trying to look beyond the histories of kings and presidents, captains of industry, explorers and conquerors of new territories, and innovators in science, medicine, and technology. Some of the pioneers attached a label to their attempt to widen historical practice: history from the bottom up, or history from below. In an article with the latter title, published in 1966, E.P. Thompson pointed out that labor history, with a focus on trade unions, had a long pedigree, but his new focus was in the history of laboring people. He looked at popular religion and popular culture, riots and demonstrations, leisure activities, and the formation of local communities. The historical profession slowly became more open to looking at people who had been subordinated in their time and ignored in ours, in terms of gender and race, as well as economic and social status. The lives of ordinary people attracted the attention of some of the great luminaries of the historical profession in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. Alf Lütke's Alltagsgeschichte was part of this trend. History from the bottom up was being talked about in significant publications into the 2020s. In an overlapping perspective appeared in the 1980s, beyond the context of European history, pioneered by historians in India and Indian expatriates, calling itself subaltern studies. Pioneers of this school, such as Ranajit Guha, positioned themselves against not just imperialists, but against the nationalist elite that had laid claim to what had been a colonized territory and a colonized population. They criticized Marxists for privileging the study of economic exploitation over that of political power, and sought to recover the lives of subalterns in a fuller sense than either nationalist or Marxist historiography allowed. They argued that within colonial and post-colonial India, there was a domain in domestic and family life that was specific to the category of subaltern. Even if Indian elites battled for power within the norms of democratic politics set by the colonizer, with their focus on the incommensurate modes of social behavior and thought between top and bottom of colonial society. So Bolger's studies saw the terrain of conflict as epistemological as much as economic or political. Of course, the practitioners of bottom-up history and subaltern studies understood that people were on the bottom because others were on top. That leaves two questions. First, whether bottom is an actual social field whose practices and beliefs can be analyzed on its own terms. To what extent do now prominent subfields of history, like African-American history, women's history, LGBTQ history, reflect coherent units of belonging and action? Subaltern's studies scholars have argued for the autonomy of the subaltern domain, sometimes at the expense of underestimating subaltern's ability to become a bit less subaltern by forcing the top to respond to them. The issue of the bottom's autonomy comes up repeatedly, not only about the boundedness of the domain, but over the relationship of scholars to their subjects. Some students and researchers question whether an elite historian, perhaps white and male like myself, can write about subalterns who were African, female, or fell within some other category. The second question is what is in between. It is that question on which I want to focus today. Many people, not just academics, are uncomfortable with the in-between. We have expressions like neither fish nor fowl in English, or ni chèvre ni chou in French, as if we want our categories to be unambiguous and well-defined. Entrepreneurs of cultural politics encourage the patrolling of boundaries, insisting that strength lies in solidarity and ambiguity is a danger. Of course, social scientists of many stripes invoke, in different contexts, the middle class, but the adjective is attached to a noun, and the implication is that of a stratified society in which each layer can be separated from the others. It was quite innovative on the part of the African historian Nancy Rose Hunt to use in a book on the Belgian Congo published in 1999 the term middles as a noun to focus on people whose lives were characterized above all by their in-betweenness. Even in the context of a racist colonial regime, which tried hard to enforce the boundary between white and black, some people, she was particularly interested in nurses, could operate with the social norms taught by the Belgians as well as those of their natal communities. In-betweenness, for them, was not a hang-up but a fact, something they had to deal with and could do so for better or for worse. Social scientists necessarily work with categories. They deploy their own, and they need to understand those of the people about whom they write. They also explore connections among individuals and among collectivities defined in some sort of categorical way. The challenge is to think in both categorical and relational ways without getting stuck in either. We shouldn't assume from the start that people whom we can characterize as peasants, as Africans, as males, act collectively and coherently. We should, however, be open to the possibility that people might do so, making class, race, or gender into the basis of collective mobilization, perhaps cross-cut by other ties. Gender history, distinguishing itself from women's history, is a good example of scholars looking beyond the single category toward an analysis that emphasizes the relationships of different genders. The field indeed implies that gender is a category that itself is constituted historically. In my field of African history, the connection of gender history and political history has been fruitfully explored. For example, in bringing out the importance of women activists in Tanzania, Guinea, and other countries to anti-colonial campaigns, followed after the success of those movements by women's exclusion from government office as a masculinist conception of power came increasingly into play. When African feminists and their allies later challenged those conceptions, they were often accused of advocating Western rather than African values, an illustration of how arguments can be based on deploying apparently fixed categories in a dynamic situation. A revealing illustration of the tension between categorical and relational thinking can be found in the contrast between a classic article from 1971 on the moral economy of the English crown and a book of 1976 entitled The Moral Economy of the Peasant. Both use moral economy as shared norms that shape people's behavior, deliberately distinguished from the individualistic conception of economy as the sum of transactions. In his 1971 article, E.P. Thompson used moral economy in a relational sense, a mutual sensitivity to an unequal but essential relationship between patricians and plebeians in 18th century England, in which each side could try to push the other while being aware of its limitations. Landowners, for a time, accepted that all people had a right to subsistence and needed access to grain even when prices in grain markets rose. Landlords expected a degree of social deference, but only so much. When those norms were violated, plebeians rioted, and both the riot and the repression of it occurred within mutually understandable limits. The development of capitalism undermined this moral economy as landowners defied the limits it had placed on their economic behavior and did what was needed to suppress the grain riots that predictably ensued. In the moral economy of the peasant, James Scott looked at the rural economy of Southeast Asia, but situated moral economy within the peasantry, not in relationship among social categories. Peasant action was in defense of a specifically peasant way of life. Scott's argument was countered on empirical grounds by Samuel Popkin in a book of 1979. He argued that Vietnamese peasants were themselves active participants in market relations, and their behavior could be explained by individualistic and rationalistic criteria. Neither stance takes full account of relations between top and bottom. A more recent study on a different part of the world by Vincent Boncasse of a protest movement against high prices in the Sahelian state of Burkina Faso showed that when protesters took to the streets, they were not situating themselves against the state, but insisting that the state had a moral obligation to them to assure access to basic necessities, a Thompsonian, relational, rather than a Scottian, categorical view of moral autonomy. The point is not to exclude Scott's vision of moral economy specific to a category from the realm of possibility. A relational analysis could show how the breaking of top-bottom connections pushed peasants into a self-contained social situation. But we will be missing historical possibilities and processes if we start with such an assumption. One could also remember that Thompson's most famous contribution to the history of laboring people, The Making of the English Working Class, is for the most part devoted to showing how English workers struggle not to be a working class, that is, not to be reduced to commodified labor power and nothing else. Some workers defended their status as artisans and the associations through which they protected themselves. Others sought protection through what Thompson later referred to as custom, as social relations within rural communities, even when those communities were hierarchical. Workers also tried to get what they could out of patricians' pretensions to paternalistic relations with their social inferiors. It was with the defeat of many struggles that more and more workers looked to find solidarity in the lowest common denominator to which they were being reduced, as the sellers of labor power. A history that can be analyzed in relational terms of shifting forms of power did in time produce a category, Thompson's English working class. Subsequent histories of this and other instances have questioned, supported, and complicated this sequence. To discuss in-betweenness in a colonial context is, it would seem, to take on the most difficult case. The colonial represents a subset of empire in which the politics of difference, which is what makes an empire imperial, is carried to an extreme. In the colonizer's view of the world, a stark and vigorously maintained distinction is made between colonizer and colonized. Especially in the context of European colonization from the 15th to the 20th centuries, distinction was racialized. But relations of extreme inequality, violent, exploitative, demeaning, are still relations. They are more complicated than Hegel's abstracted dialectic of master and slave, in which the master as well as the slave is entrapped in maintaining the asymmetry of their relationship. And they are more complicated, or at least more varied, than the psychological dualism brought out during the 1950s by Frantz Fanon. The effect of brutalization on the people at the bottom of the colonial connection and the fragility of power and the loss of ethical compass of those on top. The basic problem with these binaries is that colonial empires weren't governed by abstracted opposition of colonizer and colonized, but by actual structures and actual people. Empires are big and spread out. rulers have to understand and control diverse populations. They need intermediaries. They depend on the in-betweens. Intermediaries can be bureaucrats sent out from the imperial center, a technique mastered in different ways by Chinese dynasties, the Ottoman Empire, and European colonial empires. But they are costly and don't necessarily base themselves on very much knowledge of local conditions or on local connections. Intermediaries could be settlers who claim to be taming undeveloped lands and produce apparent replicas of at-home society linked by racial and cultural affinity to the metropole, dependent on it for protection against indigenous peoples and dependent on an imperial economy to maintain a lifestyle appropriate to their status. From the point of view of the imperial center, the danger settlers posed is that they might dispense with that center on the model of the colonies of British North America in 1776. Settler relations with indigenous peoples were often intimate as well as brutal, with the psychosocial implications about which Fennell wrote so powerfully. In colonies where rotating bureaucracies and militaries plus corporations intent on extracting profits with the least cost predominated, colonial regimes still needed intermediaries, and they often found them among indigenous peoples. In almost all of colonial Africa, the number of white bureaucrats, police, and soldiers was tiny compared to the vast spaces and populations to be ruled. Regimes needed intermediaries with knowledge of and legitimacy in local communities. The relationship of the colonial civil servant and the indigenous intermediary was highly unequal and shaped by condescension and bigotry, but it was still essential. The chief emir, prince, or king was useless to higher authority if utterly powerless and illegitimate. Recent historical research has brought out the ways in which such intermediaries can make use of the room for maneuver they had and often manipulate white bureaucrats. Whatever their followers thought of them, the chiefs had something concrete to offer to their clients: favorable treatment in regard to forced labor or in regard to taxation or perhaps access to land and other resources. These people in the middle did exercise a certain kind of power. Colonial regimes also needed literate personnel, and some colonizers believed in their cultural mission to convert people to Christianity and to educate them in what many considered a useful middle ground, enough to see the superiority of Western ways without fully mastering them. But even a little education was a dangerous proposition. Educated people could use the tools they acquired, literacy most notably, to solidify their knowledge of their own histories and their own values, rather than to succumb to the cultural norms being taught them by missionaries. Or they could pose demands in the colonizers' own terms, well aware that the way colonies were run was in direct contradiction to the Western virtues being promoted. In British India in the 19th century, political activists demanded what some scholars have called imperial citizenship, that is, rights within the British Empire. In the French Empire, the revolution in Saint-Domingue of 1791 to 1804 posed the question of whether French citizenship could be limited to white people only, a question that kept recurring over the next century and a half until the colonial system finally collapsed. When colonial subjects were asked, or rather forced, to fight in the wars of their imperial masters, they could claim that having paid the blood tax, they were entitled to the rights of the French or British citizen. The politics of claims to imperial citizenship made and denied opened cracks in the ideological edifice of colonialism in Europe, pried wider by the people whom colonial regimes had allowed to find a foothold within their political and ideological structures. The subalternist scholar Ranajit Guha once characterized colonialism as dominance without hegemony. He was using Antonio Gramsci's notion of hegemonic power, exercised by means more complicated than force, through the exercise of forms of cultural and social power that produced a fragile accommodation of people on the bottom to their subalternity. Guha thought that hegemony was a relevant category for analyzing European politics, but not colonial situations. His argument is problematic on both counts. Dominance, power through force in his terms, was a relative notion in colonies, for outside of areas of concentrated settlement or particularly high-value commerce, European forces were usually spread too thin to exercise a stable form of domination, relying instead on periodic episodes of terror. At the same time, colonial regimes were attempting to exercise hegemony, to convince the colonized that their position was in the nature of things, that some of them might be co-opted into intermediary positions, that others should accept their place in an orderly structure. For these reasons, colonial rule everywhere was unstable and vulnerable, shifting its hegemonic strategies, finding that colonial people were maintaining their own forms of solidarity, perhaps of revolutionary potential, or else finding niches in the colonial system and attacking rulers on their own ideological terms. Resistance was coming less from a uniformly downtrodden bottom than from a differentiated social structure in which people in the middle posed multiple challenges. It is important to take into account the range of affinities, connections, and aspirations that went into the struggle against colonialism, not to read history backward by assuming that the only goal was the carving out of individual nation-states from colonial empires. Only in the 1950s and 1960s did something like the nation-state become a generally held norm applicable around the world, and the relationship of independence to other aspirations was still not clear. A relational perspective can help us understand how some objectives of political and social movements could be realized while others could not be. We can begin by taking a second pairing of visions, following the Thompson-Scott views of moral economy. Here I am taking two people very much involved in the politics of decolonization of the 1950s, Leopold Sédar Senghor and Frantz Fanon. Fanon argued that colonial society was Manichaean, divided starkly in two, and the only way out of it was to reverse the dichotomy. He cited the biblical phrase from Matthew 20:16, that last shall be first and the first shall be last. Senghor, however, thought that the connection between the first and the last could be used, not just reversed. Let us look some more at these two perspectives. Senghor, poet and politician from Senegal, deputy in France's National Assembly from 1946, developed, beginning in 1948, a theory of political change based on two solidarities. What he called vertical solidarity was a relationship of unequals, in this case of the colonizing power of France and the colonized in Africa. In contrast, horizontal solidarity was a relationship among people in an equivalent geographical and cultural position, in the event among Africans. Vertical solidarity, if it continued as such, would perpetuate Africa's subordination. Horizontal solidarity, by itself, implied unity and poverty and did nothing to add to the resources to bring about economic and social change. But the two together offered possibilities for Africans to unite and lay claim to the resources of the wealthy party to the relationship. Senghor was well aware that France was in a vulnerable position after the war. In trying to re-legitimize keeping overseas territories within the polity it had conceded to the inhabitants of the of its territories, the rights of the citizen, putting Africans with their newly acquired status in a position to make claims. His proposal for a new structure for a Franco-African polity built on the layered nature of imperial governance, but took it in a new direction. Each territory, like Senghor's Senegal, would have its own elected legislature and an executive. All of France's African territories would combine in what Senghor called a primary federation, which would also have an elected legislature and executive. And this federation, along with European France and whatever other French territories chose to participate, would constitute a confederation in which all components would be considered equal, in which all would have citizenship rights throughout the entire space, and which would act as a unit in foreign affairs, defense, and other specific domains. The more radical political leader of French West Africa, Sékou Touré of Guinea, supported a similar plan for what he called the Franco-African community, until practically the eve of his famous break with French President de Gaulle over the specifics, or really the arrogance of de Gaulle's approach, of such a plan. Secretary's interest in the French Connection was consistent with his past as a labor leader, a movement that had gathered strength since the war, focused on gaining the same wages and terms of employment as workers from European France, turning the French Connection into material demands. Among political movements in the 1950s in sub-Saharan Africa, only one influential party in Cameroon advocated independence. The largest political party in French Africa, the Rassemblement Démocratique Africain, under its leader Félix Houphouët-Boigny, showed a variation of the French Connection, bypassing Senghor's African Federation in order to create a federation in which European France and each individual territory would be equal partners. Senghor's three-layer polity followed from his idea about combining horizontal and vertical connections, using the horizontal to make the vertical into a claim-making strategy, reversing colonial empire's use of vertical relations for control and extraction, was key to political strategies in French Africa in the 1950s. It may, today, seem naive that the racism so prevalent in France could be incompatible with allowing Africans to be in a position to make serious claims for the redistribution of resources. But Senghor's argument did not depend on French people giving up their prejudices. He was appealing to reasons of state, that France needed Africa if it was to be something other than a minor power on the western fringes of Eurasia. And he was taken seriously in Paris. His reading of France's need to make concessions in the face of horizontal solidarity was, up to a point, correct. Fanon came from one French colony, Martinique, in the Caribbean, via Paris, to another French territory, Algeria. He was trained as a psychiatrist and in many aspects of French culture, taught by, among others, Senghor's fellow theorist of diasporic African solidarity, Aimé Césaire. Algeria represented a different situation from Senghor's French West Africa. It was a territory with substantial settlement, hence one where the racial hierarchy was much more in the face of the colonized than in colonies where there were very few white people. Yet even in Algeria, more so in other French territories, there were people in multiple subject positions. Alongside expropriated and depersonalized victims were those who acquired a stake through education, small-scale business, or as lower-level intermediaries in the government, as well as people who found an alternative vision of life through religion, and therefore distancing themselves from an oppressive society. Algerian politics before World War II were varied, including a strong movement for the rights of French citizens, of extending the rights of French citizens to Muslim Algerians. There was the Ulama movement of Muslim scholars and clerics who sought unity among North African Muslims and the wider Islamic world. And there were movements among the many Algerians who worked in European France, some communist, some nationalist, many a combination of the two. At war's end, all of these tendencies were in play, including ideas that pushed Senghor's ideas further, calling for a recognition of an Algerian nation that would be an equal partner in a French federation or confederation. Despite the extension of citizenship to Algerians in 1946, the settlers used their citizenship to prevent Muslim Algerians from exercising theirs. Fanon's writing, particularly his Wretched of the Earth, published in 1961, should be interpreted in light of this history. His famous statement that a colonial society is a Manichaean society has often been taken as a description of colonialism. But Algerian society in Fanon's time was not divided into two fragments, but into many. After World War II, Muslim Algerians could migrate to European France as rights-bearing citizens, and their labor was at this time sought after. They faced discrimination and bigotry as well as exploitation, but they and their children became part of a growing population of people of North African and sub-Saharan African origin that are, up to this day, a vital part of French life and of struggles in French politics. In Algeria, rampant poverty and exploitation by settlers, and France's brutal conduct once the War of Liberation began in 1954, tended to produce the duality that Fanon argued was inherent in colonial structures. Nevertheless, France could recruit Muslim Algerians, the Harkis, for its side of the war, and many others found themselves in a variety of in-between positions. increasingly difficult to sustain as the war went on. At times, Fanon seemed to recognize the complexity of colonial society, complaining about bourgeois nationalists and the influence of religion. Fanon's vision of a Manichaean colonial society was an effort to make that society Manichaean, to eliminate ambivalent positions, to create a situation where people could only be on one side or the other. The revolutionary violence that Fanon saw as disintoxicating the inferiority complexes that colonialism generated was one dimension of anti-colonial politics. The collapse of French colonialism actually came through the combination of revolutionary violence a la Fanon and the politics of vertical and horizontal solidarities a la Senghor. The revolutionary movements in Vietnam and then Algeria led French leaders to realize that in order to avoid the proliferation of such movements, they had to give sub-Saharan Africans, especially those who could be considered middles, wage workers, export-oriented farmers, teachers, civil servants, policemen, material stakes in a new order. They thought they could control such a process, but they could not. In French West Africa in particular, political and social movements, especially after a wave of labor strikes from 1946 to 1950, were sufficiently successful in claim-making that officials realized that demands for social and economic reform based on the equality of French citizens would not stop until the best organized segments of society had achieved parity with metropolitan equivalents, a redistributive claim that French leaders considered unmeetable. The only way of getting African politicians to back off was to devolve real power to them in each territory. By focusing on the territory, the French government hoped to weaken the horizontal element in Senghor's strategy. It succeeded to the extent that by conceding power to the territories, the political reforms gave politicians a vested interest in territorial constituencies and in safeguarding whatever power they achieved within each territory. But that also meant that a measure of real power was leaving Paris. It was a big, if short-term, step in reconfiguring relations within an imperial system. And the end point in 1960 was a negotiated independence of French West and Equatorial Africa, but in the form of individual nation-states, not either Senghor's or Houphouët-Boigny's version of federation. In turn, the achievement of independence of most of the French Empire by 1960 became an important part of the normalization of decolonization. This remaking of international norms was crucial to France's decision to give up its power over Algeria in 1962, even though the revolutionary forces were far short of a military victory. What happened after independence in Algeria and Senegal revealed that both alternatives were problematic. Fanon insisted that anti-colonial violence could be purgative of colonial mentalities and lead to a genuine national formation. Post-revolutionary Algeria was anything but a united nation. Victory against France was followed almost immediately by civil war among factions of the independence movement. Algeria's new regime proved both authoritarian and incapable of bringing about the social transformations it promised. A bitter war between religious factions and the repressive state shook Algeria in the 1990s, and movements against an authoritarian government that still was legitimating itself through the victory of 1962 were ongoing into the 2020s. Although many Algerian workers in France returned to Algeria in the summer of 1962 to help make a new nation, many of them soon went back to France because of the conditions they faced in Algeria, helping to bring about a long-term transformation of the French population. In Senegal, Senghor became what he warned against. Without the mediation of layered sovereignty that he had advocated, struggle for control of the nation-state became a zero-sum game for limited resources. Senghor imprisoned his one-time collaborator and main rival for power, instituted a single-party regime, and ruled the country for 20 years. Although he eventually took an honorable retirement from politics, which is more than can be said for much of his cohort of first-generation African leaders. Sagor's doubts about the capacity of national independence to bring about political, social, and economic liberation were widely shared even by anti-colonial leaders who sought national sovereignty. Something more was needed. Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana called in 1958 for a United States of Africa. The Afro-Asian Conference held in Bandung in 1955 began a series of initiatives to form some kind of bloc of ex-colonial states that could challenge the dominant elements of world power on both sides of the Iron Curtain. Sangor's juxtaposition of horizontal and vertical solidarities gives us an analytical tool to examine the possibilities and limitations of these initiatives. Afro-Asian cooperation, the Tricontinental Conference of 1966, and the group of 77 states, which came together at the UN in the 1970s to demand a new international economic order, were all attempts at building horizontal solidarity on a global scale. All these efforts ran into the realities of vertical power. Ex-colonial states had the possibility of choosing their patrons, but little possibility of escaping patron-client relations. Much as capitalist enterprises had profited from colonialism, they did quite well by decolonization. They could choose where to invest and where to stay away, realizing that the governments of impoverished states would compete for their investments. Attempts to organize the so-called Third World ran into the heterogeneity of post-colonial situations. Alliances with rival Cold War powers, different resources, such as that between oil-producing and oil-consuming states, differential ties to international financial institutions and corporations, authoritarian versus democratic governments, religious conflicts. The defeat of the new international economic order does not negate the importance of continuing efforts to make horizontal solidarity of states into a basis of claims for redistribution of global resources. Such struggles have a past, and they may have a future. Successful mobilization against colonialism, after all, ended the normality of empire, which had been sustained for centuries, if not millennia, and it produced a world of states that are formally equivalent, even if highly unequal, in terms of political and economic power. The predominant form of post-imperial political organization, based on the fiction of the nation-state, emerged at a relatively recent date, and it proved to be both a liberation and a constraint, concentrating political energies in the zero-sum competition for the wealth and power that sovereignty conveyed to a state elite, while providing incentives for such elites to seek vertical connections to centers of economic power, rather than horizontal connections to challenge that power structure. Not surprisingly, the picture is not uniform. Some states have used diverse connections to prosper. Think of South Korea. Particularly in the first decade after independence, most ex-colonial states devoted more resources to education and health than their colonial predecessors, with very important consequences on lifespan, access to knowledge, and so on. Some states with the best resources, however, think of Nigeria or the ex-Belgian Congo, have experienced prolonged political conflict and continued poverty. As a result of conflict among elites, to control the connections with foreign enterprises that can enrich the few at the expense of the many. Thinking in terms of vertical and horizontal relations can help us understand what is rather misleadingly called populism. Its early South American version, inspired by figures like Juan Perón in Argentina, in that context, a leader claimed power by making himself the focus of the hopes of people on the bottom. Perón offered a measure of redistribution of resources distributed through an apparatus he controlled, but he avoided horizontal politics of the populace organizing itself to make claims. His politics was demagogic more than democratic. In the case of pseudo-populists in the style of Donald Trump, the leader poses as a personal savior, in this case of white men left behind by social change, looked down upon by well-educated elites, and threatened by people of color. The promise of redistribution of resources from top to bottom is false, but it's false that it is not necessarily an obstacle to the appeal of vertical power. Nor should we look at vertical and horizontal relationships simply in terms of states. The very inequalities of world economies have given rise to entrepreneurs who move between rich and poor states, who can convince people of vastly different worldviews to do business or to cooperate in other ways. Every poor country has its rich elite who live like the elites of rich states. Misery crosses continents too. Refugees fleeing oppressive and murderous regimes, young men whose homelands offer no chance of sustaining their families trying at great risk to find an alternative elsewhere in the world. It would also be a mistake to see these connections in static terms. Migrants adapt to host countries and learn their ways. They influence the culture of the people of host countries as well. Intermarriage and racial mixing might produce hostile reactions from both top and bottom, precisely because they blur the categories through which political solidarity is asserted. In Africa, people born of European-African mixtures were sometimes marginalized and miserable, sometimes in advantageous economic positions, and often effective participants in anti-colonial movements. Organizations of migrants and their children in both Europe and North America have pushed at the same time for civil rights and social equality and for recognition of the dignity and cultural integrity of their communities of origin. They encounter bigotry, narrow self-interest, and scapegoating, but the struggles for individual and collective inclusion continue. Social surveys show a strong difference in one generation among immigrants in access to higher education and moderately secure jobs. We need to focus on the economic and social conditions that enable people in between, especially migrants and their descendants, to live a decent life or which deprive them of opportunity and dignity. Being in between does not mean an identity crisis. Migration entails key roles for people we can call middles. Some may be people from the same village of origin who help new generations of migrants adapt. Others may be traffickers who cynically exploit migrants' vulnerabilities. Patron-client relations cut two ways, providing avenues of upward mobility for clients while reinforcing unequal power relations. Cultural mixing and cultural exclusion are both the consequences of human intervention. We need to understand how patronage and brokerage work in specific situations and how they help or harm people on the bottom end of the relationship. The tension between relational and categorical approaches is not merely a tempest in an academic teapot. It manifests itself in contemporary politics. Take explanations for riots, largely involving young men of North African or sub-Saharan African descent, largely French-born, that broke out last summer in France over the killing by police of a young man of North African descent. A leading center-right politician, Bruno Retailleau, blamed the riots on what he called ethnic regression. That is, African youth had reverted to their true ethnic nature. On the other hand, anti-racist organizations and other activists insisted that actions of youth should be understood in relation to the conditions of ghettos in which many immigrant families were confined, the weakness of state and civic institutions in those neighborhoods, and the seemingly hopeless future many faced, for which the tipping point was the harassment by police of youth who appeared racially different. To this, he added the fact that the rioters were a tiny percentage of the people from the social categories that both sides were describing, and that the majority were either bearing up under their difficult conditions or struggling against them individually or collectively. While much of the right of the political spectrum explains social phenomena as a consequence of belonging to a social category, and police act on the basis of such categorization, a portion of the left holds such a rigid view of the values of the republic, especially its secular nature, that they reinforce the sense of people of immigrant roots that difference in French society means inferiority and exclusion. Banning certain forms of dress practiced by some Muslim girls, usually a small minority of them, from public spaces on the grounds that they defy the republic's secular rules, alienates precisely those people whose integration should be of most concern. But to reply, as is often done, by positing an equally categorical France that is still colonial, is to pass over a history going back many decades of struggles that have turned once established verities into subjects for debate. Nor does the colonial label provide much guidance for how to organize for change. In Africa, too, there's also a clash between a long history of movement across space and interaction among peoples and a politics of categorical confinement. In Nigeria, for example, recognition of one's rights as a Nigerian citizen depend on the authority of the head of an ethnic group, usually referred to as a chief, in a particular locality, a process that that can result in many people being labeled as strangers and therefore excluded from national and local citizenship. Claims to indigeneity or autochthony in such situations trap people in a rigid classificatory scheme and empower patriarchal elites. We are left with a fundamental and difficult question. Can we acknowledge the claims that people make for recognition of the communities to which they belong, give weight to the pain that stereotyping and exclusion have entailed, while recognizing as well people's social as well as geographic mobility, the multiplicity of their affiliations, and the importance to many of them of spaces that in one sense or another are in between? Can we encourage solidarities through which people demand social justice without turning them into exclusionary strategies? The great anti-colonial activist Aimé Césaire said in 1956, and I quote him, "There are two ways to lose oneself, by a walled segregation in the particular or by a dilution in the universal," end quote. He was arguing that confining cultural and social life to one's own ethnic or religious category was no answer to the false universalism by which much of the French elite, left as well as right, imposed a view of French values that did not allow people to be French in different ways. I have been talking today about the fact of being in between, between the top and bottom of a social order, between different cultures and continents, but I have not been celebrating a sweet hybridity. Unequal power relations entail the possibility of contestation and manipulation, but those on top have more tools than those on the bottom or in the middle. Verticality reproduces itself. But if we, as scholars and as an engaged public, are to understand how power operates in the world, we have to analyze it with precision and not let ourselves be trapped in false dichotomies or static categories. Claymaking in conflict may end up producing polarization and division into antagonistic blocks, whether in social relations inside a community or among states at a global scale. But we shouldn't start with the assumption that such divisions are the natural order of things. Indeed, in the present and the past, many people have devoted their lives to trying to prevent that from happening, and they have at times transformed norms as well as structures. As in the past, building movements for social justice will entail thinking across social categories and building coalitions. Tackling global problems will entail action both within national states and across them. And accomplishing something will depend on developing institutional structures that can operate at different levels. The vertical nature of power relations are a reality we have to confront, not least the ability of the most advantaged to build on and perpetuate the resources they have. That leaves us with a question Senghor posed 75 years ago. Can horizontal solidarity push vertical relationships in the opposite direction, recognizing that unequal political relationships are still relationships, that people living in between not only adapt to their situation, but strive to change it? Thank you for your attention.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.